Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Your level of success has everything to do with your level of personal development. That you cannot, because it has to do with capacity. You know, when we want more success in business, the true route to get that is not necessarily more effort. It's not necessarily putting in more hours. What it needs to start with before you take those actions, it needs to start with first increasing your capacity to believe in yourself, your capacity to believe what you're capable of, your capacity to increase your level of thinking bigger by getting things out of your mindset, the capacity of stepping into what you really deserve, which is a tough one for most people. Right, because we've put a limit on what we think we deserve.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Jeffrey, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, Srini, I'm so excited to be back. It's been 3 years, so I'm excited to be here with you.
Wow, I can't believe 3 years has gone by, but I think that anytime we have somebody back more than once, it says a whole hell of a lot about their first appearance on the show. You have a new book out, The Self-Employed Life, which we will talk about. But as you know, from having been a previous guest, we're definitely not going to start there. So I want to start by asking you, what religious or spiritual beliefs were you raised with, and how did those end up impacting the choices that you've made throughout your life?
Well, I was raised in Catholicism, was essentially kicked out of the church by however old somebody is when they make their confirmation. And literally asked to leave. Like, the priest called my parents and said, either get this kid under control or, you know, he's not welcome to the church. And I asked too many questions, apparently. For this church in a small town, I just asked way too many questions. I wanted a deeper understanding. I didn't just take what they were preaching verbatim. And it wasn't liked. It wasn't enjoyed. And so what that taught me is, I think really more than anything, Srini, what it taught me is just open-mindedness, because I don't harbor any ill feelings about Catholicism. And there's a certain amount of nostalgia to it. My grandmother, who I was super close to growing up, was really devoted to her Catholic church. And so to me, I can walk into St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City and have a rush of sentimental feelings about my grandmother and about that upbringing, but it doesn't guide me in any way, shape, or form as to my own values today. But I do think it shaped a certain amount of acceptance of all religions, because I think at the end of the day, all paths that we follow have some sentimental element to it. And what we take from the lessons of that is our choice. And I choose to, I'm more aligned with the philosophies of Buddhism and have probably spent, well, not probably, I've definitely spent far more of my life looking at those philosophies. But honestly, one of my favorite books is a book called, Jesus and Buddha. And it was written by a professor of Catholicism that decided to make this side-by-side comparison between the writings of Jesus and the writings of Buddha. And it's one of my favorite books because it's just so blatantly obvious how much is similar. So that to me, I think is probably the biggest takeaway is just that it all works. It's a personal journey.
Yeah. Why do you think that more people don't question what they're being told verbatim? I don't think this applies just to religion. You see it with, you know, thought leaders and personal development gurus and influencers where people take their word as gospel instead of guidance. And mm-hmm. I've always wondered, like, why is that? Why do you think people don't have the courage to challenge authority?
You know, what's in this particular case with the church, what surprises me is that I did, because I was a horribly shy kid and just not gutsy enough. So there was, to me, there had to be something so deep in conflict that I just couldn't accept it. So to me, the answer to the question that you're asking is that I think people are not in touch. They're not relying on what they must feel in their gut. Like, they're not paying attention to the conflict and the disagreement. And at the end of the day, I think that's guided me a lot through business as well, because I just, you know, I'm always very open to learning from avenues around me. I will pay attention to what big businesses are doing and glean ideas. But at the end of the day, I lean into what feels right. So I think a lot of times, because I find that when I started out as speaking, I would come off stages all the time and people would come up to me and thank me. They'd say, you know, thank you for giving me permission. And they always use the word permission. And for the longest time, I just nodded my head accepting, but I didn't understand the feedback until I started asking for more clarification about what they felt they got. And they said, I felt like you gave me permission to be in business in a way that always felt natural to me anyway. I just didn't feel like I could do it that way. So I think the reason people follow rote advice is they just don't pay attention to the conflict they're feeling on the inside. And for me, as that young kid, I think the conflict that I was feeling about what they were saying to me and what made sense just was so deep that I was willing to speak up, despite the fact that I was the kid that, you know, in Sunday school that you wouldn't have known was there, or confirmation classes. Like, I was the one hiding in the back of the room, very uncomfortable. Really unlikely that I would speak up, but I think I did, because it just, the feeling of the conflict was too great for me.
What in particular led to that feeling of conflict when you were hearing what you were being told, and how did your parents react?
You know, surprising how my parents react, and I really was surprised. I think they saw, I have to believe, and my mom is still very devoted to her faith. I have to believe they saw some truth in what I was saying. There was something going on, I felt, kind of behind the scenes, that they believed me because they accepted it. They basically just let me make the decision. Did I want to, you know, follow that path of the church or not? And I said no, and they completely accepted it. And that was kind of unlike my parents. I think they must have seen something that. Maybe I even gained their admiration for having the guts to see maybe what they weren't willing to see. I'm sorry, what was the first part of that question? I guess so focused on my parents' response.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What is it that prompted that conflict for you?
I don't know if I recall entirely. It just was this blanket belief, like, just believe this. And I think that was it. It was just this, just believe this, don't ask questions. And whether it was faith or, you know, where, how we're going to end up, they were going to end up in heaven. I don't know what it was. I just remember, and I can still kind of recall that feeling of it just being this blanket statement. Just believe it. It's written. It's in word, right? It's in a written word, and that's not to be challenged. And I don't believe that even in the written word, that the creator of those words didn't intend for it to be challenged. It's just a thought. And it's just a thought on paper. So I think for me, it was just this the blanketness of it. To this day, I have a problem with stuff like that. I try not to speak in absolutes. And when you like using words like, well, people never, or you should, you know, when you speak in absolutes, you're ruling out the possibility of exploration.
Wow. So one of the things you talk about later in the book, which I actually didn't know until I read this book, was coming out of the closet. And I wonder what role that played in your conflict with the church. And also, what is that experience like telling a parent? Because I've asked a lot of people this question. And I know that for me, that would be such a strange, particularly if Indian parents, I can't imagine what that conversation would go like. And of course, I have no context for that because I'm not, you know, somebody who's come out of a closet.
Yeah. So, and I didn't come out till 44, right? Okay. So, gosh, Serena, this is a big one, but I'll share every bit of it because I don't mind. Well, because, you know, it's the internal conflict of it all, if you will, to me, is that I do believe that, you know, we're born, you know, as Lady Gaga says, we're born that way. I mean, I do believe that to be true, but that introduces the thought, well, then were you lying? You know, I was married for 19 years. I got married at 20 years old. I was married for 19 years, had three kids, have three kids. And, you know, my youngest, during the stickiness of the divorce, she accused me of lying, you know, during the marriage. She was only 5 years old. I mean, but that's how she was processing it. And that was the hardest thing ever for me to hear from my child, you know, questioning whether I was a liar, whether I was lying during the years of marriage. And I never felt like I was lying. And what I have come to understand about the process of coming out is that you truly do have to come out to yourself first. I do believe I was always gay. Looking back, could I have, I mean, I will tell you, anytime there was a man and woman or a boy and girl in high school walking down the hallway, I was always checking out the guy, right? But here's the thing. The way my brain was processing the checking out is I truly did not understand men. I had little to no relationship with my father. I have two older brothers that were just these mysterious enigmas. Like they just, you know, let me put it this way. When I came out to myself and walked into my therapist's office at the age of 44 years old and told my therapist with absolute confirmation, I'm gay, right? She said, not surprised. And I said, the problem is I hate men. She goes, I know that. That's going to be a problem. Right. This was both funny, but also complicated because I had not had a very positive image of men in my life. So to me, I did look at men, but I was trying so hard to figure them out. I don't think I collapsed it into a sexual attraction. It just was like, what makes men tick? And hey, I'm still trying to figure that out. I mean, I still somewhat jokingly say to my female friends, I'm like, I don't know how the human race has continued. I said, because I don't get men. Like it's still challenging for me. So yes, I think we're born gay. And I think that there's a lot of information we gather as a kid. I never had a thought that I could have been gay or that I should come out until sometime around the age of, you know, 33, 34, at which point I granted myself permission to ask myself the question. And when I did, it was obvious to me. And wow. Then I came out. As the coming out process, telling your parents, my father passed away when I was 20. He was 52. And who knows? I mean, I wonder whether I would have ever come out if he was still living. I don't know. Because he was that powerful of a figure. I'm not sure that I would have. But when I came out to my mom, it was a combination of being quite funny, but also a little hurtful. And we've definitely recovered from that. But when I first came out, and I talk about this in my TEDx talk, because literally when I said to her, I said, you know, and I was always told to be very definite. So I said, Mom, I'm gay. And there was silence for a second. And this is on the phone. I didn't have the guts to do it in person. It was over the phone. And she said to me, is it because you moved to New York City? And, you know, but the funny part about it is she actually wasn't wrong. You know, and that's really what the basis of my TEDx talk is that often people can see more in us than we can see in ourselves. And the reality is, since I had moved to New York City, a lot of people had questioned my proclaimed straightness. A lot of people were asking me, are you maybe metrosexual? Like, are you sure you're straight? I was getting a lot of that. And it did introduce the questioning. And that's, you know, think about how often people do come out in our lives and we're not at all surprised. Or people say, well, I knew that. I was just waiting for you to discover it. So she wasn't entirely wrong, but that was quickly followed by, I love you for who you are, but let's not tell anybody. I'm like, but mom, that's not loving me for who I am. So we had our times to work through, and she did, and she doesn't even give it a second thought now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Wow. So I have one follow-up question to this. How does this end up changing the relationships in your life, particularly with your kids, your ex-wife? I mean, I know this is not the common story of coming out when you're a teenager, and you know, you did it so much later in life, which is really different than a lot of the people that I've talked to.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and mind you, and this is because I respect you so much. I don't share this a lot, only because I just don't want to introduce more confusion. But I was married a second time when I came out. So I had been married, as I said, for 19 years, divorced for reasons having nothing to do with this, was was divorced for 5 years. And in that time, dated women and got married a second time. And it was a year into that second marriage that I came out. So there was impact on a lot of people. As to the response of it, first of all, I think I give full credit to my second wife for creating an atmosphere of safety that even enabled me to consider being true to myself. She also was just the perfect human for me. You know, I mean, we were so compatible. The respect I had for her is immeasurable. I did love her, and there was something missing. And that was a big part of the questioning. I'm like, I literally found the soulmate of my dreams, and I knew that, and there was something missing. And what I realized was missing was I've kind of thought about it as passion, that we don't talk about what passion really is enough, because what I felt was missing was the passion to fight for success in the relationship. And it wasn't just sexual passion. It was, you know, as marriages do and relationships do, we would hit bumps. And I just didn't have an innate passion to save what I knew was the perfect relationship. And that's what got me questioning. It's like, what is missing here? I should be fighting for this. I want this. I love this person. She's fantastic. When I came out to her, she actually congratulated me. She accepted it, went on with her life. We remained friends. My kids, who were, they were at the time five, 8, and 10. And they couldn't care less. Literally, I remember the exact phrase. I sat all three of them down around the dining room table to tell them. And one by one, my son said, "I don't want to know what's going on in your bedroom now any more than when you were married to my mother." my oldest daughter, like there's like an align by age. My next child, my older daughter, she said, "Great, now we can go shopping." Like, we've always gone shopping. And then my youngest said, "I don't care, you're still my dad." And then collectively, they were like, "Can we go for ice cream?" Because I had promised them ice cream. And that was it. That was it. It was there has never been, all three of the kids are just incredibly accepting. They've seen me go in and out of a couple of relationships. It's taken me, I'm in a healthy relationship now, but it took me several to get my act together because I've had a lot of internal conflict in my life around men. So it was very hard for me to figure out how to relate to them.
Well, you know, I think we all have some version of something like this in our lives. It may not necessarily coming out as gay, but something that we're denying, some truth about our lives. How do we stop denying that truth? I mean, because I think that's like a perfect segue into this whole idea of wanting to be self-employed. But so often, I think people are denying some truth that has just been eating at them inside.
Wow. Boy, if I knew the answer to that, I mean, couldn't I save humanity? I mean, that all I can do is explore the question because there's no absolute answer to that. I do believe, I mean, my TEDx talk starts with walking out on stage and saying we all have closets to come out of. I don't tie it into my own coming out story till much later on in the talk. But the reality is I truly believe we all have closets to come out of. There are all ways, we all have ways in which we are keeping the best of ourselves hidden, that there's something we're hiding. And what I propose as the solution to that is to listen to the feedback around us, that I truly believe often people see more in us than we see in ourselves. I think it's very hard for us necessarily to see what we're hiding. I think we have an inkling. It hasn't been awoken. But I think if we start listening to what other people see in us, which is sort of in an odd way, it's sort of what the experience I was having when I moved to New York City. And I got curious about the whole idea that my TEDx talk when I was watching the Tony Awards. And I've watched a lot of award shows. And I don't actually watch a lot of TV, but I love award shows because I like to see people get appreciated for their work. And I was watching the Tony Awards and it struck me how often people express their gratitude for their success to other people. They thank their peers. They thank their coaches. They thank their high school teacher. And I realized how often people that have achieved big goals in their lives reflect back on people that saw something more in them than they saw in themselves at some time in their life. And that actually began the process of what became my TEDx talk, of just thinking about how it's called the validation paradox, because I think there's a way in which we go through our lives trying to validate ourselves. We're trying to find ourselves. But the paradox of that is I actually think often other people see more in us than we see in ourselves. So as far as what, how does one go about revealing that? Chances are there's some inkling, like what some, there's some way in your life that you know that you could be more, that you could be bigger, you could be happier. There's an inkling, which is kind of dormant. And I think the way we wake up that dormant seed is by paying attention to people's other people's reflections of us to allow us to step into the questioning.
Well, I think that makes a perfect segue to actually getting into the concepts in the book. So, you know, as any author is asked when they have to write a book proposal, why this book? Why now?
So the crazy thing is actually, I avoided the entire process of writing a book proposal. I got a publisher on an email because I had somewhat of a relationship with the publisher because I've interviewed a lot of their authors on my podcast. But I also believe my clarity and commitment to this topic was so clear. I truly believe they saw it. The publishers saw it. This actually wasn't the book I set out to write, but at the end of 2019, really the fall of 2019, but I actively started writing towards the end of 2019. I was actively writing a book that was sort of an iteration of my previous book, Lingo. And it was kind of a deeper dive into things I had learned since the book had been out there. And quite honestly, it was suggested to me to take that route because it probably would sell a lot of books. If I looked at the path of other authors where they introduced a concept book, and then after the concept book, they took a deeper dive into something specific of that concept, that follow-up book often did really well. And it actually would be an easy book to write. So I started writing that book feeling some, I don't know, I just felt like I wasn't really being myself. I felt, because I am a heady guy, I am a deep thinker, and I felt like this was kind of a very light version of myself. But hey, it would sell a lot of books, and I was very interested in that. So I was going down that path, but then at the same time, I was asked to speak at a conference that I've spoken at many times. It's a big conference, and I typically deliver a lot of business content at this conference, and I just didn't know what else to deliver business-wise. So I went out on a limb, created a talk called Life is an Everything Bagel, and it was an exploration of, you know, how we go through our lives choosing between things, but it's not until we stop choosing between things that we actually can choose everything. And I even did some background study on the history of the everything bagel and you know, how that came about and kind of compare that to life. And it was a very, very coachy talk. I have over 1,000 hours of training as a coach, but I've always felt like I had to deliver such tangible business lessons to people that I almost shoved the coach in me back in the closet. It's always been there. And that's what I do for a living. I mean, my primary income is as a coach, but when it came to how I needed to deliver as a speaker, I always kept that a little quiet and just delivered amazing value. But this talk, I went for it, and it wasn't my best talk. I think some things resonated really well with the audience, some things didn't. Afterwards, the feedback was not my best feedback, but I knew I had broken through something that I needed to do for myself. And I left that conference and from the plane texted my editor and said, I'm writing the wrong book. I'm going to drop it. So I did. I dropped that book with a little quiet time. Felt like I just had this urge to write this book for self-employed people. And in the end, it's the thing that made the most sense. I've literally never had a traditional job. I've never received a paycheck. And this seemed like the most obvious thing after 36 years of being in business since the age of 20. And yet my self-employment journey began as a teenager. You know, after my entire life, of course this made sense. And this was in January of 2020. Well, by March 2020, we know what broke loose. And it was at that point that my commitment to this audience really ramped up because I was fearful of what was going to happen to small businesses, even more fearful that self-employed businesses would be overlooked by our government because they always have been. And you know, I heard grumblings of a CARES Act. I have a lot of connections in politics, so I actually was given the 800-page document to look through. And much to my surprise, it was the first time in U.S. history that self-employed business owners were called out in a piece of legislation that would receive financial help through the PPP loans. And that to me was like a crack in a window. I was like, holy crap. The government, for the first time in history, is acknowledging that self-employed business owners matter to the economy, because there's no other reason they would give the help. This wasn't coming from a place of kindness. And, you know, but without that help, Srini, you know, we would have ended up with a $600 stimulus checks, or most people would have, right? A $600 stimulus check. Like we can run our lives and our businesses on a stimulus check. But that's what would have happened in the past, because in the past, all the help went to banks, big corporations, and at best, small businesses. But the problem is, you can have up to 500 employees as a small business. And it has always left out the person who's brave enough to go out on a limb and support themselves, not live on government aid, but support themselves by building their own business. The bravest thing I think you can do, and yet always the first ones left out of help when it was needed. And so to me, just the idea was there. The window is cracked open. I'm like, I am never letting that door close again. I am stepping forward as not just, you know, I said to my publisher, I'm looking to be an advocate. I'm not just looking to be an author of a book. I'm looking to be an advocate for this audience. So I sent an email to the publisher and said, here's my concept. And they did a quick search on Amazon. And wrote back to me and said, well, we just searched in Amazon and the top 10 books about self-employment in Amazon are about taxes.
Wow.
And they are. And I did the same search. There was absolutely nothing that had anything to do with what self-employed people know actually matters. How we live, what mindsets we need, the strategies we need. And so my commitment to this work of art just ramped up. And and there it is.
Well, let's get into the book. You know, one of the things you just said is that you've never received a paycheck in your life. And you open the book by saying the great paradox or myth, lie, conflict, or whatever you want to call it about self-employment is that we're going to gain control of our destiny, but we're entering into completely uncontrollable circumstances. I think that's enough to make a lot of people lose their damn minds and not do it in the first place. So how do you navigate that, you know, idea of uncontrollable circumstances without losing your mind?
Yeah. And that comes from asking countless number of self-employed people. And everybody has the same answer. Like, why'd you go in business for yourself? Oh, I wanted to control my destiny. And I'm like, how's that going for you? And everybody laughs. Like, you know, it's not. And there's like this myth. And it is an interesting paradox, because there's a way in which, you know, we go into business for ourselves, wanted to control our destiny. We're not stupid. There's a way in which we know in our minds that, you know, it's not easy. We know that life is not controllable. We do it anyway, thankfully. But then we get in there and we're like, holy crap, this is more unknown circumstances than I could have imagined. I mean, a year and a half ago, who would have known a pandemic was a factor we needed to consider in business? You know, we've always thought, okay, the economy can go up and down, market trends change. Somehow we naively think that that's never going to happen during our time in business, right? So we know some outside circumstances. The things that we don't expect, you know, certainly acts of terrorism, you know, now pandemics, like there are things that were not on our radar before that are now. But the other thing I think that we just cannot be sufficiently prepared for is the interconnection between our personal lives and experience and our business. It is just the whole idea that, you know, business is business, don't take it personal, does not apply when you're self-employed. And I don't think we can prepare ourselves for the integration of our emotions into the business, as well as what I think is even more significant, the interconnectedness between our personal development and our business. I fundamentally have come to believe that your level of success has everything to do with your level of personal development, that you cannot, because it has to do with capacity. You know, when we want more success in business, the true route to get that is not necessarily more effort. It's not necessarily putting in more hours. What it needs to start with before you take those actions, it needs to start with first increasing your capacity to believe in yourself, your capacity to believe what you're capable of, your capacity to increase your level of thinking bigger by getting things out of your mindset, the capacity of stepping into what you really deserve, which is a tough one for most people, right? Because we've put a limit on what we think we deserve. You have to expand that in order to actually have a place for the effort that you're going to do to fit in. So I think that's, you know, we just can't, we think we're prepared, but we can't. And what I propose as the solution, which is part of the root of your question, is what I teach in the book, what I call the self-employed ecosystem. And that's how I've broken it down. I've broken it down to what I see are three big elements, what I refer to as the self-employed ecosystem, that like an ecosystem in nature, all three elements have to be thriving in order to not only survive, but thrive as a self-employed business owner. So I think there is the main premise of the book, I would say, is that we can't control the circumstances that are uncontrollable. What we can control is the environment we set up for the results we want. That we can take control of. And that gives us, I think, a 90% chance of getting what we want.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to this idea of you know, personal and business, because you say that no matter how hard we try to compartmentalize things, it's all integrated when you're self-employed. What goes on at home affects work, and what goes on at work affects home. We're challenged every day, and yes, we take it personally. I think the reason that that had struck me so much is because I've noticed that as a public figure, there's had to be some separation between who I am, you know, around my closest friends versus who I am in the public eye. You know, I learned this from being on reality TV. I learned this from going off the deep end after a breakup where one of my mentors said, "You're a fucking train wreck. Like, you can't behave this way on social media." And so for me, that was sort of a delicate balancing act, because I can tell you for, you know, damn sure that I'm not going to go into an investor meeting and cry about a breakup with some girl, because that's just inappropriate for that context, even though it is a big part of my personal life that's affecting me. And it definitely affects your ability to run a business. And at the same time, there's sort of a line that you can't cross, at least I feel like. And I'm wondering, you know, what your take is on that, given what you've just written here about the connection between the fact that it is personal.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. When you are a public figure, I think that gets more complicated, you know, and I probably have an increased level of empathy for celebrities and people that I see in that situation. I love Brene Brown's comment on that. She something to the effect that if you're not in the arena getting your ass kicked, then your opinion doesn't matter to me. And that has helped me a lot to stay authentic despite occasional criticism or misjudgment. That's a tough balance. I mean, I think we have to, the challenge is staying true to yourself, but it not being out there in the world for everybody to project their opinion on. For me, the way I handle that is my rule is that I only talk about or teach, if it results in a teaching lesson, I only talk about something I've learned usually from my personal life or a personal life experience, if it has application and benefit for others to understand. I only share it in hindsight, never in the moment, because in the moment, you're too wrapped up in the emotions and it's almost inevitably going to come across as self-centered or self-processing. It's too soon. But in hindsight, you can share a lesson learned from life to the benefit of other people. It's not an easy task, you know, and I like I said, I probably am more forgiving than most because, you know, hell, there are people that are financial gurus who go through difficult financial times. And that doesn't discredit them and how they can serve other people while in that moment they're unwinding from whatever circumstances they're going through. Yeah, I think once you've put yourself in a public spotlight like you have, I mean, I think it complicates it holding on to what really makes you authentic. But again, that kind of goes back to what I'm saying. I mean, that the connection is that much deeper that you're left with more to manage about that connection.
Well, I mean, I always jokingly say, I say things to my roommates on a daily basis that are a public relations crisis in a making that I would never say on air.
Yeah,
I mean, Danielle Laporte echoed exactly what you said about this. She said she never writes about a difficult experience until she's done processing it. Right. And we have this guy, Stephen Goldstein, here who had worked with a number of politicians. He booked guests for Oprah. And, you know, he said something along the lines of no public figure is 100% authentic because it's just not feasible to do that and be in the public eye.
Yeah. Yeah, I would guess I would. I mean, boy, there's so many layers to authenticity, though, right? I mean, I think there are some people that might be more authentic when they're in the spotlight than they are behind the scenes. I mean, there's a way in which, I love and I'm so passionate about what I do. I think in some ways, I almost show up more authentically through my work, because when I'm on, I'm on. And when I'm on, I flow more freely. I mean, to be honest with you, Shereen, what you're likely to see of me outside of conversations like this, outside of the work I'm doing, I'll give you an example. Last night was a Zoom launch party for my book launch. And my partner, I don't think he got two words in yesterday. And I suddenly realized it. And he and I were sitting side by side. And, you know, I was in my moment. I was with my people. I had a pumped up day and I'm on fire, and I feel my most authentic self. And that's how people see me. And I think they're really seeing the real Jeffrey Shaw. But I'll tell you what, when he and I go out to dinner, he's the one getting all the attention. He's interacting. I'm just sitting there quietly like a fly on the wall. And because that's my space when I'm not on, if you will. And it begs the question, which is the more authentic? I think I'm more authentic when I'm on. But, you know, so I don't think we can assume we're more authentic in our personal lives, because in my personal life, outside of my work, I'm a pretty quiet mouse. I'm not somebody who draws attention at all. And yet I do in my work.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's a really interesting contrast. As you've learned by now, I tend to ask questions that don't have answers.
Yeah, and I love that because it gets me exploring it at the same time.
Well, let's get into this whole idea of the self-employed ecosystem. You say by having a system of the outcome you seek, you're far more likely to see it come true and recognize the achievements along the way. By doing the personal development work to unblock what's in your way, you open up opportunities that will prepare you for success. Having effective strategies and action steps for your businesses that really work will make your success inevitable. By having the habits that support you every day, you stay on track, you're far more likely to see the results of your efforts. And I want to start with the personal development component of this, because you may have been reading some of what I've been writing on Facebook. Like, I'm writing a new book called Not Another Damn Self-Help Book, in which I'm actually questioning a lot of what comes out of personal development, because I think that for a lot of people, they get stuck in the personal development component of this, and they don't do the strategies and action steps, and they don't think about the habits. And personal development is just a form of mental masturbation because it doesn't lead to anything. And I think people get stuck in this vicious cycle. And so let's start there, because clearly, I don't think that personal development is useless. I've built a career out of it. I've written books that would be categorized as self-help books. And at the same time, I see so many people who read all these books, go to all these seminars, and nothing changes.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And the way the book ends, I think, also addresses that question, because I was given an exercise by a writing friend of mine to write what I feared would be the worst review of the book. And what I feared would be the worst review of the book is that people would accuse me of just being all, you know, sitting around the bonfire singing Kumbaya, that there was going to be this, you know, that what you're saying is, because I believe so strongly that that attitude doesn't help people. You know, just this whole, you know, sit around and, you know, I'm in Miami. I mean, there's more than enough of that down here. I mean, I have gone to entrepreneurial groups and it's just so out there. I'm like, but you all aren't doing anything, you know, do something with that. I mean, I obviously believe in personal growth, but do something with it. And even right down to the daily habits, I'm very clear to say, look, you know, I'm not talking about things that are going to take up hours of time every day. I'm talking about 15 minutes. Like, and here's exactly what you can do in those 15 minutes, because I've seen tangible results. You know, one of those practices is what I talk about, and I know I'm skipping over your question a little bit, but just to reinforce your point, one of those practices I talk about is a what's going right journal. And I'm very clear to explain that gratitude journal didn't work for me, and maybe it doesn't work for other people, because it's so freaking broad. And it's very self, and gratitude's a great emotion. The problem is, I don't see any value in journaling about gratitude, because if I wake up in the morning and the sun is shining and I'm breathing and my dog is with me, I'm pretty grateful. But what do I do with that? Because I want tangible results. So I turned it into what I call a what's going right journal, where I journal for 5 to 7 minutes of what's going right in my life, which during the most challenging times is the hardest thing to do, but the most necessary. Why? Because there's scientific proof that what you focus on, you get more of. So how do I rewire my primitive survival brain that's always looking for threats, that's always looking for the negatives, which is always looking for the one criticism amongst 9 compliments? How do I retrain that brain to see more of what's going right? So I started a journal called What's Going. I started at a very low point in my life, because I knew I needed something that produced results, and I've stuck with it for years. So I agree with you. Like, I think self-help without action is just nice to, I mean, I tell you, and if you've not had him as a guest, a guy named Brant Menswar, I think you guys love each other. Brant wrote a book called Black Sheep. And Black sheep is about what he calls your black sheep values, right? Which are your unchangeable values. And what makes them a black sheep values is like the sheep of a, like the black sheep of a, like the black wool of a sheep. It can't be dyed. It can't be changed. So these are your values that can't be changed. So, but before he wrote the book, and quite honestly, the idea for the book came from this conversation I had with him. His speaking career took off and I reached out to him. I said, Brant, what the hell have you done? Give me the strategies. Like, I want to know, you know, I'm thinking he's going to give me action steps. And he said, I got in touch with my core values. I'm like, how did that help? He said, well, the more I understood my core values and shared them, people that believed what I believed were showing up and hiring me. And next, you know, and his speaking career took off, like in volume and in his rate. And I said to him specifically, that sounds great, but I don't have time for nice to haves. Does this have tangible benefits? And he said, yes. I said, then I'm in. I will hire you to help me with this process. Okay, so that's just who I am. Like, I absolutely 100% believe in personal development. And I believe in how awarenesses can lead to action, which can lead to results. Otherwise, it's just sitting on the bonfire.
Yeah. No, I love this idea of black sheep values, because it just, anytime I hear something along those lines, I remember this quote that Justine Musk, that I quote frequently. She said, if you have a bold and compelling point of view, it's going to piss people off. And I realized, you know, I think finally when we made the shift from, you know, Blogcast FM to Unmistakable, it was largely because I had finally gotten in touch with what actually mattered to me, which was I hated everything that looked like it was mimicking other people. And amazingly enough, everything took off from there.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I credit Brant with doing the work with him to get in touch with my core values. I credit him with creating my first ever about page. But I never had an about page because I'm like, I don't even know what to say. You know, I never knew what to say on an about page. But once I got in touch with my values, I'm like, I'm all in. I know exactly what to say. And my about page is like, here's what I value. Here are the organizations I support. And here's what I prioritize. Like, literally, that's what my about page looks like. And, you know, as about pages often are, it's like the most visited page on the website. And people that get that, it has drawn a lot of wonderful people into my life and a lot of great, because Brant was right. It's like, I put myself out there in all my truth. If you either agree with it, or if you're intrigued by it, you're likely to reach out. If you are vehemently opposed to what I'm saying and sharing, then you're not my people, and that's okay.
Yeah. Well, that makes a perfect segue to talking about two concepts that really resonated with me, which you called embrace hug marketing and creating an emotional journey. And you say, you know, when you see it as your job to emotionally move people, you shift responsibility of being successful from the customer yourself, which gives you more control over your business. And it's, you know, to now that I'm talking to you about it, I realize everything that I attempt to do on the podcast centers around one idea, which is emotional resonance. You know, is this going to have emotional resonance with somebody? And so the thing is that that's also somewhat vague, right? It's like, how the hell do you create emotional resonance? And you say the journey on which you take your visitors, whether it's prospective customers on your site, readers of your blog, or listeners of your podcast, is a blend of consumer behavior psychology and the subtleties of your audience. So let's talk about how to take people on that journey.
Yeah. And a lot of that comes from my previous book, Lingo, too, which is, you know, an emotional branding strategy, right? It's how to... And it's also the story of how I built my photography career, because I ended up serving, you know, as you may recall, I ended up serving a very affluent clientele that is not where I came from. And in order for me to do that, I had to emotionally understand their resonance, right? Because I realized the power in marketing, the power in sales, if you will, the power in everything in business lies in the power to emotionally move people. And one of the greatest freedoms I gained in business is that when I made the internal shift many, many years ago about, first of all, I was never uncomfortable with sales, but the biggest internal shift was when I no longer saw it as sales as convincing people of anything, but rather emotionally moving them. And I was also, being a photographer at the time, I realized what an amazing advantage I'm at, because there's two steps here. I need to emotionally move people through photographs of their loved ones, then I can move them to a decision, right? And the decision I'm looking to move them to is a substantial investment in photographs. But that changed my whole mindset about what we typically refer to as sales, and looked at it more of my responsibility and all of our responsibilities to emotionally connect and move with people before you try to move them into anything that you have to offer. And that's what I mean by the shifting of the responsibility. I really feel like it shifted the weight of, and that was many years ago for me. And I just continue to do this. I look at a website and that's the strategy I teach on this emotional journey, which is an expansion of what I taught in Lingo. Because in Lingo, you know, I had the brand message strategy down. What I didn't see coming is that once the book was out, what I would get hired most to do and what my primary income to date is I rebrand through messaging people's web homepages, not even the whole website. I mean, there's a connectedness, yeah. But I really just focus on the homepage because the homepage is everything. If you don't get people, if you don't emotionally move people within seconds on a homepage, your interior pages are irrelevant. They're not going there. So there's a huge weight of responsibility on emotionally moving people as soon as they land on a website. So what I started, people started calling upon me to say, hey, could you take your concepts and lessons and Lingo and help me recraft my brand messaging? And I said, right, as 3 years later, it is my primary source of income and made for a very healthy business during the pandemic because a lot of people were taking the time to do that and realizing that, as I kept saying, during such a crisis, every business needs to reconsider their brand messaging, right? Because the world had changed.
Yeah. Well, I, in the interest of being completely selfish, I'm going to have you actually go through this, like if you can do it as a mini version with me on my website, just so we have a concrete example.
Okay. So let me pull up your website.
Keep in mind, we're also A/B testing a lot of things. So.
All right. Good thing I'm in front of a browser. All right. Okay. So, and you want me to offer you feedback on the website?
Yeah, let's just start there. If I want to create an emotional response in somebody who lands on this page, which, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, because with Unmistakable, visuals are a huge part of what we do, but there's more to it than that. I know words are also a big part of what I do.
Yeah. So first thing, and I'm going to start pretty basic, is, and again, I'm at unmistakablecreative.com. I'm assuming it's the site you want me to look at. It's not functioning aligned with today's users, in that it is a landing page that you have to click through to something. And the reason that's critical is that at least 70%, and you know what, Srini, for your audience, I'd say 90% of visitors to your website are on mobile devices. And people on mobile devices innately don't like to go to interior pages because, and every performance metric has shown that, because it takes too long to load on a mobile device. And there's no true menu, right? So you just have the hamburger menu. There's three lines. So step number one is you've actually created a barrier because it's a landing page to which there's no place to go until you click on something else. So what I teach in the book, what I refer to as the emotional journey, is actually a scrolling homepage that takes people on a journey that the real goal is that the journey you're taking, the emotional journey you're taking your website visitor on is so complete that they go from being compelled to contacting you and have never left the homepage. Now, that's not to say there shouldn't be interior pages, but here's the reality. If you go look at consumer behavior today, you have to think about the 10-second visitor and the 10-minute visitor. They're both out there, but by far, just due to lifestyle today, most people that we're reaching are 10-second visitors at best. To me, it's that those are often your ideal. I think there's another line of filter here, if you will, that they are your ideal clients. People that have, this is going to, I think, turn most people's thinking upside down. But as a business, your customers that have less time are likely your best customers. Okay. Which, because that means they're going to be quicker to make decisions. They're going to be quicker to move on, and they're far less likely to drive you crazy. Right. Often our worst customers are those that have too much time in their hands.
Yeah. I can relate. Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually like to embed in the experience ways in which we're attracting that ideal customer, that which is likely to be the 10-second visitor, that they can be sold on what you have to offer and never leave the homepage. Because the messaging at the top is compelling enough. And if you look at in the book, if you look at the emotional journey, it lays out in steps like this, like the opening, what I refer to as the opening scene, that has to be super compelling. It has to have what I call a standout statement. It's very different than a slogan or tagline. Your standout statement lets the world know what you stand for, who you stand up for, and it's so compelling that it stands out. That's the hook. You get them there. You're usually backed up with imagery, which you're amazing at. Your imagery is amazing. No question there. It needs to be followed up with, especially in today's world, what I refer to as an empowerment section. The moment you try to take someone's power away, they will back up. That's why we don't like to be sold to. You have to give them the power to, you have to let them think that they're coming to the conclusion to choose you. In fact, Forrester Group recently did a study that proved this, that they said that today's consumers have made up their mind 70% to choose you before they've even reached out to you. Okay, they're self-vetting, right? And that's why you want to empower them to make that choice. Again, it kind of goes back to the core principles in my book, that it's creating the environment for the results you want. You're creating the environment for them to choose you, but you're letting them feel empowered to have made that choice. Because the moment you tell somebody, you can trust me, they don't trust you.
Yeah.
Right? The moment, and this we see this all the time, how many businesses say, we're the best on our industry. The moment you've told me that you're the best, I don't believe you. The moment you tell me you're a genius and you know who I'm talking about, I know it's not true. You know, so that's why you really, that empowerment section is when they really get emotionally hooked. Okay. Then you walk them through this process of on the emotional journey of kind of talking about, you know, the benefits. And I look at the benefits too, like what's the benefit of what your field, like what's the benefit of what you have to offer? Still, you haven't spoken about yourself yet. And it's not until the next section that you then portray the benefits of choosing you. But again, imagine the journey. So far, you've emotionally connected with them when they landed on the website. You've empowered them to choose you. You've helped them imagine what's possible in their lives through the industry that you're in or what you do. It's not until the next section that you even talk about yourself.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's what's critical in marketing today, because it's about them. It's not about you. My websites all end with what I call an authority section, which is a little bit of a challenge to Simon Sinek, who I adore and respect. But the whole concept of start with why doesn't work in the emotional journey of marketing. Because when we start with why, it means we're often talking about ourselves. And it's about the visitor. It's about the other first. But you end with your why. You end with your authority section. And then the overriding feeling you want people to get at the end of that journey on the homepage, at the end, you want them to feel like it's no wonder this is what you do. They get your story now. They get your values. They get your understanding of who you are after they've learned what you do. And they're like, well, it's no wonder this is why you do what you do. I can see it's meaningful to you. And that just seals the deal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, even when we took Ramit's copywriting course, like everything was about shifting the language from I to you.
Yeah.
Well, like in the interest of time, we've talked extensively about habits on this show with people like James Clear and a bunch of other people, but I want to dig deeper into the business stuff. And I think the thing that struck me most here was this idea of a business model of multiples. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that and talk about that? Because I think that to me, the reason this intrigues me is because creatives are notorious for having 1,000 different ideas, moving a mile in one direction and, you know, 1,000 in none. And at the same time, you actually say, if there is to be a niche, it's not the one thing you do, it's the one thing you're known for, your area of expertise. But this area is spacious and has breathing room. Your area of expertise is your core brand message and standout statement. So how do you balance this idea of a business model of multiples with also being focused enough to make progress in one area?
Yeah, I think, you know, as I think the theme of our conversation today, it's you know, I think everything in life is art and a science. Right. So there's an art and a science to this. And I just know that as a creative person my whole life, that I have suffered under the idea of being told to sit still, focus on one thing, pick a niche. And that is really, I spoke earlier about the permission people feel like I granted them. I granted them permission to be in a business in a way that actually leverages their creative mind. because I'm sure you felt the same way. Like that has been a spirit killer in my life. And I see it in other people's lives that when we're told to, you know, you're too much, sit down, focus on one thing. And then I go into business and people like pick one thing to do to one audience. And what I've come to realize, and we're seeing it being a far more popular today, is no, the niche is not one thing you do and for one audience. Your niche is your area of expertise. Like I had a very clear goal, Srini, and it's working. I wanted my name to be synonymous with all things self-employed. Like when I wrote this book, this was a big shift for me because prior to this book, if you asked me who I was for or whom I was for, I would say entrepreneurs. Well, you know what? There's a lot of people in the entrepreneur space, a lot of so-called experts, and it's so broad. I don't even know what that means. But I want my name to be, when people say Jeffrey Shaw, self-employed, I want those things to be synonymous because that's my area of expertise. And it's already catching on. I mean, I'm having people refer other people, speaking engagements, clients, they're referring to because they're like, hey, talk to Jeffrey Shaw. He's the go-to guy for all things self-employed. Okay, so that becomes my area of expertise for which there are multiple audiences. I mean, think about how many different types of self-employed businesses are. So there are multiple audiences and there are multiple ways I can communicate that. I can write books. I can be a speaker. I can have a podcast. I can, you know, I can do webinars. There are multiple mediums by which I can help that audience. That's why I refer to it as a business model of multiples. Now, the logical side, I said art and science, the science side or the logical side of that is I don't think anybody can manage more than seven levers is what I refer to them. And I refer to them as levers because being creative, I need a visual. And I think a lot of people do. And I look at it as the business model of multiples is like standing before a control panel of seven levers at the most. And you know what? All those levers may not be firing at the same time, but they exist. They're there. Like my podcast, I haven't really put a whole lot of effort into monetizing the podcast. So the lever is there. I know it's an avenue. I know it's a potential income stream, but it's kind of ranked, you know, it's kind of pulled down at the moment. My photography lever, now, you know, 10 years ago, that was 100% up, but I've been pulling that down to do very little photography today. I don't think anything gives us more control than getting to the point that we can look at our multiple streams of income, no more than seven, from what I've observed in people, I don't think anybody can handle more than seven. And they may not all be firing at the same time, but you know that they're there. I don't think anything gives us more control than to know that it's our choice which levers we pull down, which ones we push up. Now, it's not to say that circumstances are going to come down along and yank down a lever. Like last year for me for speaking, practically overnight, that speaking lever got pulled straight down to nothing. The good news is that I had built a decent reputation for brand messaging. So I took that lever and ramped it up and wound up having a terrific year in 2020 while other streams of income were non-existent. But the power comes in knowing that you have the choice and that you have a diversified enough business. And I helped a lot of speakers last year. I spoke at, you know, National Speaker Association events, helping speakers who had, you know, their one and only source of income was speaking. And now what? You know? So that's why I teach the business model of multiples. It's both a way to leverage the most brilliant of minds, those that see more, hear more, and feel more. It's a way to leverage that and contain it at the same time.
Wow. Wow. I love this because you've packed this with a combination of thought-provoking and incredibly practical insight. You know, usually when people write books like this, like you said, it tends to be a bit kumbaya, but this is the thing that I really liked about this was there were very practical and applicable ideas. So on that note, I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask before. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, it's what makes someone unmistakable is that it's from what comes from the inside, out. It's something that radiates. You know, a good friend of mine, her book is about to come out and it's called Swagger. And be another great person for you to speak with, by the way. And I've really understood that when people have swagger, it comes from the inside. You know, and as a photographer, I can recall photographing people that had a certain swagger. And I've come to, for me, and it's not her definition, but my definition of swagger is being comfortable in your skin. And I think when we see people that are comfortable in their skin, they're unforgettable. There's something so beautiful. And a branding client I'm working with is, we're doing all her branding around the word gorgeous. Because I think gorgeous is very different than beauty. You know, somebody's gorgeousness comes from inside. I gave her the scenario. Gorgeousness is when you're in bed with someone you love and you roll over and you're just waking up in the morning and you roll over and the breath is bad and the hair is disheveled and you roll over and say, hello, gorgeous. Why? Because you see their gorgeousness. It's that thing that radiates from the inside and comes out. And that I think that's unforgettable in people.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and wisdom and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
You know, my main website is jeffreyshaw.com. But if it's in particular the self-employed world, then I would go to the selfemployedlife.me. Because it not only features the book, it really is the world of all things self-employed that I'm creating. I've started an advocacy group so that I can be an advocate for self-employed business owners at a governmental level. I recently hosted a two-day online summit called the Self-Employed Summit. I'm writing articles. I'm a contributing writer for Entrepreneur Magazine. So all of that is at the selfemployedlife.me, because I do look at that one single page as kind of the world I want to create as a world of resources and support and companionship for self-employed business owners.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.